It's a mighty lonesome sound you brought to the table today, Charlie.
Quite the scream, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the sound of a red-tailed hawk. And I am trying to plan out my trip to go to Hawk Ridge this fall to see the migration.
Nice.
That's been on my list for a number of years. I've never quite managed it. Now, you made it out there once, right?
Yeah, kind of last fall, actually. Just a mistake, kind of on the way up the North Shore. And we drove that way, just that we thought, oh, let's see what it's like. And it turned out it was one of the big days there and got to chat with you. We had missed most of what went on, but we got the feel of what it's like there and the kind of, you know, phenology types, do you know what I mean? That are willing to, like, ask questions and tell you what to do and include you. It was very phenology-like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, a welcoming crew. That's good to hear. And, yeah, I wasn't really sure what to expect when I go there. And it's good to know from you that there isn't, like, a building or anything. It's just a group of enthusiasts. Because I, too, was expecting there to be, like, a big building and an observatory. Yeah. And...
Well, there is a gift shop on wheels that has information.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, like a, like a, you know, a trailer kind of thing that's pretty cool that sells stuff. And so there is something there. But I just assumed it would be a big visitor center or something like that. That's Charlie Mitchell. I'm Heidi Holton. You're listening to the Season Watch Pod on this. Are we in our final week of August? We are, right?
We are somehow.
Whew.
I know. Final week of summer.
So when is a good time to be going to Hawk Ridge?
I think it's in season now. It'll be continue to be good, I think, throughout September and October.
Okay.
They have an amazing website. If you just Google Hawk Ridge Duluth, it'll come up. It's hawkridge.org.
Okay.
And there's a visitor's guide there. And then the other thing is you can see the data each day through Hawk Count.
Nice.
There's a live fall count data. August 15th through November 30th is when they keep count. So, yeah, I definitely recommend checking out their website, hawkridge.org.
Once again, a great point that folks can find out information like this, even if you aren't making it to Hawk Ridge this year. You can find out what they're doing and see some numbers and spend some time checking it out. Hawkridge.org.
Yeah.
So how jealous were you that we got to talk to Andy Try this week on The Morning Show?
I am so jealous every time you get to talk to Andy Try. Talk about my kind of person. Mm-hmm. Andy Try, the bear guy, is our DNR bear expert.
I think one of the things I love the most is, I mean, it always comes across how curious and fascinated Andy is. Even the dumbest bear question you might have for him, he just loves talking about him. And he has sort of his pileup of jokes that he says, and I love that. It always makes me laugh. You know, he said something about 2.7 babies in the
2.75 cubs per
mom. The 7.5 gets a little messy or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, he loves talking about it. How about you? Have you had any bear sightings or things going on where you are, Charlie, this year?
Not recently. Okay. Which is good because our feeders are out and we haven't been taking them in every night. We've had a raccoon that occasionally comes by, but no bear sightings recently. Generally, we get the bears in, you know, May, June, sometimes into July, and then it seems like there's enough food out there that they don't bother with our trash, and so on. But I don't want them getting to, like, human food sources, so I don't want them in my yard, but I also want them in my yard because I want to go see them.
Yeah.
So it's a blessing and a curse to not be seeing them.
This is a special edition of Season Watch because we get to hear the conversation with Andy Try, lead on the bear project at the Minnesota DNR. He is definitely the bear guy for the state of Minnesota, and we'll get to hear from him, and then we'll have some talkbacks, too, in this half hour. That's John Latimer. I'm Heidi Holton. Tornado Bob sticking around and joining us now is Andy Try. He's Bear Project Leader with the Minnesota DNR. Thank you for coming in today.
Happy to be here.
Oh, should we start off with the first question that we got?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I think Julia from Bemidji wrote in. She said, we walk a few trails near home daily and we are pretty sure we're reliably seeing the same two bears, but you can disabuse us of that notion.
One is notably larger than the other, but the smaller one does not seem so small to be a cub. We generally see them in the same area of the trail, just never at the same time. Have you ever seen this before? Is it possible they're actually together?
Yeah, it's quite likely, actually. Generally, if you see a large bear and some number of small bears with, those are offspring born in January. In Bemidji, there's lots of oak forest there and really good foods, and so those cubs grow quite fast. And, you know, they might be 40, 50, 60 pounds. Some of them, by the time they den up in that kind of transition zone of the state, you know, Bemidji, Brainerd, over to Pine County, we've had some bears in the den in March after they've lost weight, about 100. So certainly could be a cub of the year. It's just they grow real fast.
Do they ever, man.
Is this so, the eating time of year right now?
Hyperphagia. Fancy $5 term for eats a lot.
How many calories do they need to accumulate?
Oh, there's so many different estimates, but the one I cling to most is 20,000 calories a day.
A day.
A day. Yeah. Like that's the Michael Phelps training diet.
Yeah, right.
Twice.
I'm like 9 days behind every day. I'm probably 2,000 calories, and I probably only need about 1,500. But yeah, I get it. I have a question. This possibly mother and cub. How many do they? Is the average offspring of a good healthy sow?
Yeah. So it kind of depends on how old they are, but the statewide average over four decades really hasn't changed. It's 2.7. That 0.7 cub is a really messy business when we go into the den. I'm joking. It means three is more common than two. We've had as many as five in the den.
Five?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And pictures of six based on a trail camera photo in Crow Wing County.
Wow.
So, you know, she's digging a den for all of the kids plus her for the whole winter.
It's and just you're telling us that these might be 50, 60, 70 pounds if they're in a good food area.
Mm-hmm. It's just crazy.
Nice and warm in there, I'll bet.
No doubt. Generally, like the first time moms, they'll have smaller litters. One to two is more common, but yeah, two and three is most common here all the way through most of bear range.
And what's the survival rate?
Really, really surprisingly well. You know, I go talk with bear biologists all over the country, and they're like, yeah, cub survival is 20, 30%. No, it is really good here. It's right around 80%.
80? Mm-hmm. So if she has four babies, three of them are pretty much assured.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Very good cub survival.
Yeah, why is that?
Bears up here are good moms. We have pretty reliable food sources, like our forests are quite diverse for all kinds of food sources. And so even if there are two or three or four things that fail, there's still a few things out there, you know, plus the human stuff that we don't want them eating. But in general, we have a nice diversity of foods up here that really allows them to balance it out if things go bad.
Can we talk a little bit about some of those food sources?
Absolutely. It's one of my favorites.
There are a lot of things out there that I know that bears eat that I have tried and found to be foul. Or in the case of skunk cabbage, really not pleasant at all. But yeah. Skunk cabbage was like early season. I was out looking for the flowers and they were all eaten. And so I took a little tiny piece and tasted it and my mouth burned for about 4 hours. But let's not talk about that. So this time of year, I noticed at my house that they had just gone into the choke cherries and just literally pulled the trees down and stripped all the berries off.
Yeah.
What else?
Yeah. So cherries are prime time this year. It was a really good cherry year, both for pin and choke cherries.
Mm-hmm.
Raspberries hit kind of on average. Blueberries, where you found them, were quite abundant. I saw lots of pictures of like thumbnail sized blueberries, like market sized blueberries.
Wow.
But it's kind of variable. You go 10 miles away and there's nothing. That's just the nature of the forest. But yeah, blueberries, dogwood berries are a big one. That'll give you gastrointestinal distress, but the bears eat them a lot. Red osier is a huge one in those kind of that wet country because you get two flushes of berries rather than just the one.
Right.
Pagodas or alternate leaf dogwood looked really good this year. That's all stripped clean. Elderberries in the early summer, those were good this year. Also picked completely clean, but we're in nut time right now.
Yeah.
Acorns. Hazelnuts, those are the two biggies. and it's a great hazelnut year. Like the bushes I've been seeing, especially Americans, are just drooping with nuts.
I saw the same thing, but gone. I mean, my first note of absence was the 8th of August this year, and by the end of that week, the 15th, I couldn't find any. They were absolutely consumed.
Mm-hmm. Everybody in the forest loves hazelnuts.
Apparently they do. Now, I've got a really good crop of red oak acorns, and I can't really tell you what my white oaks are going to be. It's hard for me to see them now, partly my vision and partly the fact that they're hidden in the leaves. But
well, it's partly that, but it's also that it's just not a great bur and white oak year anyways. And you're probably straining to see not a lot there anyway.
Okay.
But yeah, good. Red oaks hit really well this year. Pin oaks farther south are also hitting well. The red oak group is rocking and rolling this year. Those are those trees that it takes 2 years for an acorn to set. And so we're dealing with last year's abundant rains that got them started, and now we're reaping those rewards. But yeah, with how dry it's been, I'm seeing abortions of white oak acorns. Like they'll drop what they have, the tiny ones, and just drop them early, and they're going to try again next year.
Yeah, they'll come back.
We did just get a text in to 218-326-1234. Chris from Deer River says, does a bear wake from hibernation starving? Is their first meal vegetation?
They don't emerge starving. It takes a few weeks for their bodies to get back to active. There's quite a lot of like stretching and getting their muscles going. Lots of bear yoga poses that we see. Downward facing bear is quite a common one.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And then, they don't have food until, even the first bits of green up aren't usually until like the very end of April, often in May up here.
Yep.
And so they're eating skunk cabbage, which is thermogenic. It creates its own heat, melts the snow. That's one of the first things. But they'll rip up wetland grass and they'll eat that first inch of the cortex of the grass, which has a little bit of higher sugar content. And then as soon as those red maple flowers open up, they're going after maple flowers, they're going after willow catkins, willow buds, aspen catkins.
Yeah.
That's the most of their diet till the ants show up.
I've actually seen a bear like take a young aspen, pull it over, put the branch in its mouth and just strip it out.
Yeah, and so they've got a gap between their canines and their premolars. It's another $5 word called a diastema. Deer have this too, but they don't eat like bears do. And so the bears will put that cane of raspberries or a branch and just use those prehensile lips, strip all the food off, and then get what they have. Yeah. They're not as picky with blueberries as we might be. Right. They'll eat the green and the blue.
I often compare my berry picking to the style of the bear. It's off the bush in the mouth. There's not a lot of in the pan kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm a very much a blueberries for sale kind of picker.
Yes.
So, I was kind of curious about like population fluctuations in the state. It seems like, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago or whatever, I didn't see that many around when I first moved up here in Grand Rapids. It was rare to see one. Now they seem to be a bit more common. I see more. They're coming to my house in town. for that reason, I don't have my bird feeders. I don't restock them anymore. And then the past couple of times I've gone back and forth to the cities, I see bears crossing the road. So they seem to be more of them out there now. And what sort of influences the population trends that we've seen and up and down?
Yeah. So the largest mortality source for bears is regulated hunting. Here in our Chippewa National Forest study, about 80% of all the things bears die from. Now, we're not saying 80% of the bears die every year, but just of all the things that can kill a bear, 80% of that is regulated hunting. And so from an agency perspective, that's really helpful because we can increase or decrease the number of tags given out in the lottery to help, manage that population. So when you first moved here, it was kind of the bottom of the statewide population. We were coming off a peak in the late 90s, early 2000s. There was something like 20 to 25,000 bears statewide. And we had surpassed what we call societal carrying capacity. Certainly lots more bears could have been on the landscape, but when they're messing with crop fields and busting into properties and that sort of thing. It's just that's how a lot of agencies manage, is just what social tolerance is. And so in the late 90s, we issued a lot of tags. It dropped the population, which was the goal, but more quickly than we had anticipated. And so from the peak of 20 to 25,000 in like the year 2000, we had dropped to a bottom of about 10 to 12,000 by 2013. And we've slowly been recovering there since. The places with a lot of oak forest and a lot of crops and a lot of productive bear habitat, ironically, it's the edge of Bear Range in Minnesota that's the most productive habitat, not the core here. They just have more oak, more acorns, and they just do better. Those populations have recovered more quickly, but now we're seeing, you know, in the heart of Bear Range, bear populations are recovering, and it's in a good spot. We've been able to give out more tags this year. The wait times have decreased a little bit, but bear hunting also is super popular now. It's the most popular it's been in over two decades. 26,000 people apply for those tags every year.
And how many tags are there?
This year we gave like 5,300 or so.
Okay.
We just got a text in. I love this. As my husband and I were having coffee in our screenhouse just now, a black bear, probably a two-year-old, walked through my big flower bed about 100 feet from us and proceeded on his morning walk. He or she comes through here and to the neighbors every day. We don't want him hunted, so I'll just say we live southeast of Rapids. Wow, right as we're talking about it. That's great.
So I'm curious, Andy, you talked about the better recovery or better population recovery at the edge. How broad is the bear population in Minnesota? How many, where are the bears?
Yeah, it has drastically changed in the short time I've known you, John. So I've been with DNR 11 years now, and our bear range is very widespread. We started a bear sightings app. A bear sightings web database on our website for people just to publicly report bear sightings outside of primary range, kind of like, you know, you would iNaturalist, Eber, that sort of thing. And since 2018, we have 4,500 observations the public has reported. And they're as far west as the Red River Valley, pushing into the Dakotas. North Dakota has a reproducing population, very small, but they have a population. There are bears showing up in South Dakota now. I was dealing with calls from a biologist over in Watertown that was having some of our bears follow the Minnesota River and then up big like Lake Traverse and shooting over the border. In the far southwestern part of the state, they're pretty rare, but pretty much from the Canadian border down through the 94 corridor and even a little bit farther south, they're fairly common. And there are resident bears in the 494, 694 loop in the cities. We have bears in the east suburbs, the west suburbs. They show up on the south side. And then in the southeastern part of the state, in the driftless country where there was unglaciated, there is a small population there as well. But also, Wisconsin has a population. Iowa has a population in the far northeast part. And they just follow these river courses and show up in town. And then it's a big to-do because people are not used to seeing bears. But Minnesota is bear country. Pretty much anywhere in the state except for the far southwest region, you're going to run into them from time to time.
So what was, historically, what was the range of the black bear?
So we don't know, aside from the, you know, some of the traditional accounts and some of the early explorer accounts, but generally you didn't see black bears outside of the forest. And so
they weren't south in North Dakota. That wasn't bear country. Or black bear country.
Not black bear country.
Right.
We did have grizzly bears in Minnesota. The last one was shot outside of Itasca Park in 1865, I believe, right at the tail end of the Civil War. We did have a few grizzly bears in here, but the prairie bear is the grizzly bear. There probably were black bears along the river corridors where there was quite a lot of vegetation where they could hide. But the main way that black bears flee any sort of predators or danger is by climbing trees. And if there's not a lot of trees out in that sea of grass, and so the grizzly bear does better in general.
Okay.
We just heard from our friend Noah in Britt. He says, when we first got honeybees, it didn't take but a few weeks for a bear to help himself. An electric fence went up that night, confirmed on trail cam that bear learned the next night. This year, on two occasions, silly me, I mistakenly left the electric fence off after working on the hives. On both occasions, the bears have gone for the hives. Do you think they somehow know the fence is active? Maybe they hear the electronic fence Maybe they hear the electronics, but how do they know to be wary if they haven't been zapped before?
That's a good question. I don't know all the mechanics of it, but they can tell. I don't know how they know.
I wonder if they can feel it through their whiskers when they get close, if there's enough of an electrical field around the wire. I don't know either.
Yeah,
suppositions.
Certainly it's possible. I mean, animals can detect electrical currents, you know, generally. Mm. But the other thing is that bear will keep coming back and testing it over and over and over again. You know, if it feels on, they're not going to hit it. But the moment it's like, oh, okay, let's risk it, then they'll plow right through. And it's the larvae that they're after, not the honey. You know, Winnie the Pooh is an odd bear because, well, A, he's fictional, but B, he likes honey. Yeah, that's a sweet treat, but they're really after that high protein larvae.
Is that why they tear apart these ant mounds and eat ants?
That's high protein. Half of their diet in June is vegetation, and the other half is insect larvae.
Wow.
Whew. Yeah.
We heard from Lucy. She has a question for you, Andy. Is there any effort to construct wildlife overpasses to protect our wildlife from road kills? This summer, there were two bears killed on Highway 169, both north of Arum Lane.
Not that I'm aware of. In general, road kills are a pretty small proportion of the overall bear mortality. But there are places in the state that are building, I think, wildlife underpasses for smaller critters like turtles and that sort of thing. I think there's one going in somewhere down by Winona. But not what you're imagining, like in the Bow River Valley of Alberta, these huge, massive overpasses. They do work well, but you have to be very careful to find those pinch points and make sure that the there's lots of fencing that has to go up, and it's quite expensive to do that. So in general, our bears are actually quite wary of crossing roads. It's often the younger bears that are naive, and or if it's foggy, usually around daylight savings time, that switch, we see a ramp up in car collisions. But it's just because we're shifting our activities relative to the bears.
Yeah, from what I've seen of bears, it's like they're looking around and seeing when there's a gap between cars, whereas as opposed to deer that just sort of like look at you, and then if they panic, they're coming right at your car.
Yeah, in fact, some colleagues did publish a paper on this based on road crossings in the Chip and down near Camp Ripley with those heart monitors that are implanted in these bears. And as you might imagine, their heart rate quickens when they get near the roads, and they're hypervigilant. You know, it's sometimes this stress response that people worry about. You know, chronic stress is not healthy for you, but the stress response is like an innate animal ability to deal with threats. And a car certainly is a threat. Their stress level goes up for a little while. They cross, they move away from the road, and that heart rate drops back down.
Wow. Andy, we could talk all day. And I would love every speck of it. Thank you so much for coming in. And final words, bears, bear hunting.
If there are bear hunters listening, we have about 50 collared bears statewide. Most of them are north of Grand Rapids in the Chippewa National Forest study area. Otherwise, we have some at Camp Ripley and the Brainerd-Baxter area near the Pillsbury. So if the one comes into your bait with large cattle-style ear tags, it's got a collar. If we could, it's legal to kill them, but we would prefer that you pass. If there's a bear with small little 1-inch by 1/2-inch tags and no collar, by all means, take that. Just call me when it's done so I can mark that line off in the spreadsheet. These are bears we've handled, but are not part of the study currently.
All right. Thanks, Andy.
And folks can go to the website, too, to submit bear sightings. Did you say that?
Or? Yeah, absolutely. Okay. They can honestly just go to their favorite web browser and search MNDNR bear sightings, and it'll pop right up.
All right.
Great.
Sounds great.
Thank you so much.
Oh, man, I am so jealous, Heidi. What a great interview. Andy's always phenomenal. The classic John Latimer of Andy was talking about how much, like, the huge amount of food bears need to eat. And John Latimer said something like, oh, and I've tried a lot of bear foods, and it's not good. He talked about eating the swamp cabbage and how it stung his mouth for hours.
Yes. Burned his
Very
mouth.
John Latimer.
I know. Like, I'm kind of like a bear. You know, how come it didn't work for me? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and the 20,000 calories twice a day, the Michael Phelps diet that they are needing right now is how Andy puts it. Whew. And we're talking berries and acorns, you know?
Yeah. It's not like they can, you know, pound a dozen eggs that they pull out of the fridge. That's, amazing. And just the amount of time, you know, I had read that they cut down on sleep during this time of year just because they just need to eat. But yeah, that's a lot of effort. And then the mama bears having to dig out a den for mama bear plus the pretty darn big cubs now. And with a little bit of room for whichever cubs are going to be born during the winter. That's a pretty decent excavation, I'd have to imagine. I think a lot of us who live here love living here because of the chance to see wildlife like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've been appreciating through my work here is learning how much invisible labor goes into keeping these populations around.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad the bear population is doing great, but every time now that I see a trumpeter swan or a bald eagle or an otter, I'm thinking now about these folks at the DNR, especially like the non-game DNR program, who have like reintroduced trumpeter swans to Minnesota or spread otters further, like when they were extirpated, brought them back. Like, even moose habitat, like, now that we no longer have natural processes taking place in a lot of, like, northern Minnesota, there's actual work that has to be done to make sure that moose have, like, that fresh, young growth to eat. And so every time you see a moose, you have some random forester or DNR person to thank for it.
Hmm.
And it just, yeah, there's at the beginning of Braiding Sweetgrass, a book by Robin Wall Kimmerer, she asks a class of undergrad students for examples of good things that humans do with nature. And they couldn't come up with anything because we know so many ways that we mess up. And yeah, I think through like these interviews with Andy and, you know, some of the other ones, it makes me appreciate all the good work that's going on.
Well, Charlie, to end our program today, we're going to listen to one of the reports that came in. But I want to give you the chance, as school is beginning, to mention some of the things that KEXE can offer teachers.
Absolutely. So we have the Phenology in the Classroom program, where any teacher who's interested in getting their kids outside, observing nature, fits into a lot of different, you know, curriculum parts. You can do science, you can do math. When you come in and perhaps record your observations for the radio, that counts towards English requirements, public speaking requirements, all sorts of things. We have some onboarding documents and a sample script that you can just kind of fill in with your observations. Great experience to hear from these classrooms throughout the state, what they're seeing and how things change depending on where you're located, from Baudette all the way down to New Caledonia.
What's the best way for people to connect with us?
You can contact me at cmitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L, at kaxe.org, or comments at kaxe.org.
All right. Next, we are going to hear from Roots and Wings.
Roots and Wings Forest School. This was their Girls Adventure Camp.
This is Girls Adventure Camp reporting from Gwendolyn State Park, August 20th. I saw a bunch of fish when we were tubing, and when I tried to grab one, it darted away like a bolt of lightning. And when we went fishing, and when I chopped off a piece of worm to go fishing, I accidentally dropped it back into the box, and it started wiggling by itself.
I learned and saw that monarchs love these little pokey flowers called thistles. They have a lot of nectar in them, and their favorite color is purple, and they love to aim for those purple flowers because I think they can see better with them and probably have a lot of nectar in them.
When we were going for a hike, we saw a gull nest for flies that they lay their babies in there, and then the babies eat their way out of the gull in goldenrod.
I saw a sycamore tusket moth caterpillar. It was white and fuzzy, and it had a little red tiny face.
I saw a skink in the prairie. I learned that they also like the prairie as well as like watery areas.
I saw a few flitteraries, and they were black and orange, and they're different than monarchs, and they are so cute.
I saw a dead silverfish on the side of the lake.
When we were going on a hike, we saw lots of toads jumping out of the grass on the sides, and they were very warty and green.
Thanks for listening. Stay wild.
Support for Season Watch Podcast comes from the Sugar Lake Lodge near Grand Rapids, a Northwoods setting on the shores of Sugar Lake, offering lodge rooms, cabins, and golf villas, with on-site dining, a golf course, and access to the lake, trails, and seasonal outdoor recreation throughout the year. Plan your stay at sugarlakelodge.com.